Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. If you're part of the growing number of Americans living on the coast, get ready. Seas are rising and chronic flooding will soon be the new normal. And we're talking about more than just basements here. High tides will regularly flood schools and hospitals, make streets impassable for commuters and emergency responders. And according to a new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists, disrupt regional housing markets and trigger widespread economic crises. This hour on Point, the real cost of rising seas. You can join us on air or online. Do you live near the coast? Are you dealing with chronic flooding problems already? Tell us about your experience. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. My first guest today is Jonathan Foray. He's a resident of Houma, Louisiana. Jonathan was born and raised in southeastern Louisiana and has watched his community change as the floodwaters have gotten higher and more frequent. And Jonathan, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Anthony. It's good to be with you.
Can you tell us a little bit about where you live in southern Louisiana and how more and more flooding has changed the way you and your family live down there?
Sure. I live in Terrebonne Parish, which is one of the southernmost parishes in Louisiana. And, you know, my dad grew up in Cocodrie, which is the town southernmost in Terrebonne. And when he married my mom, they bought a house in Chauvin, one community up. And then in 1985, when our home flooded for Hurricane Juan, my parents drove around and looked for land that was a little bit higher that they could build a new home. And so they did, and they moved one community north of that to Berg. And then when it came time for me to purchase a home, I went one community north of that to Houma. And so this is, you know, a pretty common story of people sort of already moving north over generations. And so that's, we've seen some schools that are in the southernmost part of the parish close already because there aren't families that live in that area to support all of the, you know, that there aren't enough children there for to keep the schools open. So it's really changed our community. And as those people have moved north, we've seen recreational fishermen move into those areas. So those houses are now second homes for people who live in other areas who enjoy the fishing that our parish has to offer.
I understand. So, Jonathan, you're living on higher ground now. Your parents are too. But other members of your family, I understand, still remain under risk of chronic flooding. Tell us about your uncle, what he's dealing with.
Yeah, so my uncle is living in the house that he grew up in, that my grandparents owned. And that house floods, you know, fairly regularly. And so he has done things to make it a little bit easier to recover from that flood. So, you know, the floors in his house are cement, and so it's easy to wash out the silt that has come in with the floodwaters. And his walls are built in a way that the bottom parts of them can be taken out fairly easily and then replaced. And so, you know, people are having to adapt to life with a little bit more water.
Got it. Jonathan Foray, stand by. I want to play a little tape. This is from a 2013 documentary, Can't Stop the Water, featured the Île-de-Jean-Charles in the town of Île-de-Jean-Charles in southern Louisiana, which is essentially washing away due to erosion and sea level rise. And one resident explains how the town has changed.
Years back, we used to play back in the woods. It used to be full of woods all over. Now, they don't have hardly nothing left back there. A couple of dead trees and bushes, that's about it. The salt water done killed everything.
Salt water killed everything. That's from the 2013 documentary, Can't Stop the Water. Jonathan Foray, I mean, does it ever... Well, let me just ask you straight out. You're not tempted to just say, you know, I can't live here anymore under this kind of growing threat.
This place is so unique and so special to the people who live here that for many of us, it's not an option to move. We're going to live here for as long as we can. And we are doing things to enable us to do that. You know that there are lots of mitigation efforts taking place, levees being built, floodgates being installed, marsh creation projects that are trying to build out the wetlands to sort of absorb some of that, some of that water that's coming in. So, and elevating homes, you know, so I think many of us plan to continue living here for as long as possible and trying our best to find a silver lining in all of this, because it is really easy to get caught up in the doom and gloom of the situation. But we also, as a community, have to focus in on, are there any opportunities that we can harness in dealing with this situation and figuring out how we can adapt to live successful lives here.
Right. Last question. You know, you mentioned some of the big projects there. Do you feel, I mean, the big projects to essentially protect your homes and mitigate against rising waters, do you feel that the government is doing enough, either local or federal government, or do you not look at this as a problem that government can fix?
You know, locally, the people of Terrebonne Parish have taxed themselves to be able to build this levee system, because I think we're aware that, you know, nobody's coming to save us. We would like that to happen. We could use all the support and all the help that we can get. But at the end of the day, if we have to rely on ourselves, then that's what we have to do, because we do love this place so much. And so, I mean, I do believe that government has a role in this. And for us, our local government has been the one that has sort of stepped up to the plate to help us the most.
Well, Jonathan Foray of Houma, Louisiana, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful. I wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you.
Thank you.
And joining us now in the studio is Rachel Cletus. She's the lead economist and policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she's co-author of the group's new report, Underwater: Rising Seas, Chronic Floods, and the Implications for U.S. Coastal Real Estate. You can find a link to this report, which is fascinating and alarming, at our website, onpointradio.org. Rachel Cletus, thank you for coming in. It's good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's a lot to get into in this report, and we're going to have plenty of time to do that. But I'd love to just get your reaction to what you heard Jonathan Foray describing down there in southern Louisiana as you listened to him.
Well, Mr. Foray has pointed out the human cost of sea level rise. So our research, of course, that we're going to discuss today is going to put some dollar figures on the amount of coastal real estate at stake. But in the end, this is about people's homes, about people's lives. And as Mr. Foray pointed out, frontline communities are dealing with this reality even now. This is not about something far in the future. This is already happening. And they're struggling, frankly, to cope with the impacts of it. Louisiana, coastal Louisiana, is ground zero for the impacts of sea level rise. They're seeing among the highest and fastest rates of sea level rise in the world today because of additional local factors like land subsidence. So it's a tough, tough situation.
Indeed. So this is a problem that you've been looking at for some time, but this report really offers, it's really the first attempt to put a dollar amount on what is really a slow motion crisis unfolding. So give us the headline here. What did you find in terms of the overall economic impact about of this unfolding crisis?
Well, in a nutshell, what we found was that accelerating sea level rise in the lower 48 states in the U.S. is primarily driven by climate change, and it's projected to worsen tidal flooding. And it's going to put as many as 311,000 coastal homes with a collective market value of nearly $120 billion at risk of chronic flooding just within the lifetime of a mortgage, so by 2045, within the next 30 years. And that number jumps up significantly when we look out to the end of the century, when we have 2.4 million homes and over $1 trillion worth in today's dollars, those homes are worth, that is at stake.
So what is the big financial impact of this? I mean, I think we can sort of get our heads around the idea that if your house ends up underwater, you know, we can sort of begin to understand the significance of what that means to our personal economy, not to mention our personal lives. But what does it mean? What's the sort of bigger societal impact of this problem?
So what's happening as seas rise is that we're seeing high tides get even higher, and they're reaching further inland on what was formerly dry land, and we're seeing places that are regularly flooding at high tide. And what our research does is look out further into the century as sea levels rise to see how much worse this chronic flooding will get. We set a pretty conservative threshold. Places flooding 26 times per year or more are what we consider to be at risk. And what we're finding is that homes at risk are, of course, just the tip of the iceberg, because in the path of these high tide floods are tons of infrastructure, lots of other property, roads, et cetera. So we've just put a dollar figure on just the residential and commercial property at stake, but there's a lot more at stake. And while it starts with individual property owners, it quickly spreads out into the wider economy because, of course, communities that are depending on their local tax base, which comes through the value of these homes, will find that their tax base is threatened as the property values decline. That means they're less able to fund critical services and infrastructure. This also means that banks that have made mortgage loans on these homes might find themselves in a financially challenged situation, coastal property investors, insurers, and there will be places where so many homes in a small geographic area are exposed that you start to see a regional economic crisis start to develop.
So we heard from Jonathan Foray down there in southern Louisiana. You referred to that part of the country as ground zero. Where else? What other areas are most acutely affected by this pending threat?
Well, our research showed that in terms of the numbers of properties and the dollar values at stake, we see some places really pop. The state of Florida, for example, and New Jersey top our list of places exposed. In the case of Florida, for example, the areas around Miami, the Florida Keys, and Tampa St. Pete have a lot of property and people in harm's way.
All right. We'll talk more about Florida. We'll talk more about New Jersey. We'll also, listeners, talk about what part of the world you live in. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're discussing a new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists that forecasts widespread economic crises as the sea levels rise and coastal communities flood more regularly. Ellicott City, Maryland, drew national attention this past May as it faced its second devastating flood in as many years. Here's Maryland Governor Larry Hogan on CBS Baltimore.
They say this is a once every thousand year flood, and we had two of them in 2 years.
Ellicott City is still reeling from a catastrophic 2016 flood that killed two people, decimated Main Street, and cost around $20 million in damage.
And here's Christy Dahl of the Union of Concerned Scientists speaking to NJTV last July about what chronic flooding would mean for those who live on the coast. Here's what she had to say.
There are a lot of communities in New Jersey that will start to see this chronic flooding in just the next 20 years or so. And so for those communities that are facing this very near-term chronic flooding, we need to start thinking about the way we're living along the coast. And that could include making some adaptations like defending the coast, using seawalls, accommodating the rising tides.
You can join the conversation. Our state and local governments responsible for protecting against rising sea levels. If people want to move inland, should taxpayers help foot the bill? My guest today is Rachel Cletus. She's the lead economist and policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Rachel Cletus, we've got a bunch of listeners who'd like to get in on this conversation, so let's go to them. Let's start with Susan, who's calling from Beaufort, South Carolina, Beaufort, South Carolina. Susan, you're on the air. Good to have you. Thank you.
This area of South Carolina is called the Low Country. In 1893, 3,000 people, they estimate, were killed when the last major hurricane hit. I live on the Morgan River. My home is 20 feet from the water, 3 feet above the ground. It is 20 years old. We carry state wind insurance. We carry federal flood insurance, which only pays $250,000 if the house is lost. We also carry fire and comprehensive insurance. In 2015, when Hurricane Matthew hit, as my husband left the house under mandatory evacuation for the county of $200,000, he said to me, if this comes during the high tide, the house is history, but that's why we cover insurance. $250,000 would not have begun to cover the cost of replacing the structure. We had a VA mortgage on the house of $350,000. We had put down another $400,000 in cash. So the taxpayers would have lost out in addition to us, the homeowners. The state of South Carolina, people have complained about the premiums for flood and wind insurance, and the legislature always looks at reducing them. That means there's less money to pay claims.
All right. Susan, I got it. You laid out quite a situation there, and we wish you all the luck in the world down there in Beaufort, South Carolina. Rachel Cletus, listening to our caller, your report talks about how most homeowners, most communities, most investors are not really aware of the risk that is not very far away from us.
Yeah, that is, I think, the most sobering thing about our findings is that, for the most part, this risk is flying under the radar on the coastline. Frontline communities, of course, as Susan pointed out, they're right there. They see what's happening in their streets and to their homes. What they need to be aware of, though, is also as sea levels rise, these risks are going to worsen. And what's really important, just listening to Susan, what is really important to recognize is that this shouldn't come down to individual homeowners and communities trying to navigate their way through this very daunting challenge all on their own. There really is a national imperative to get our arms around this and provide options to local communities and homeowners, ways forward that will help them cope with the problems of today, but also with an eye to the future, to get people and property out of harm's way.
Is among the challenges of having this alarm be heard and appreciated, I would think it might have something to do with folks who aren't right on the coast, and so they don't think of themselves necessarily as affected by this threat. So, I mean, I'll give my own personal example. I know Boston is an oceanfront city. We've seen flooding recently in this city. I live just outside of the city on high ground, so I might be forgiven if I think, well, this isn't really going to be my problem. But of course, it will be.
Absolutely. The greater Boston area is one of these places that is very exposed to sea level rise. The city of Boston itself got a pre-taste of what this might look like through the winter storms we had earlier this year. You know, our research shows, for example, that the areas that were flooded in the Seaport District by Grayson are likely, just through tidal flooding, to be inundated by the mid-century mark. This is the kind of thing that we have to use as a warning signal for what lies ahead. And it's not just the city of Boston. There are lots of working class suburbs here of Revere, Quincy, Hull, Winthrop, where there's a lot of property that's exposed that can significantly affect their local tax bases, and where people, for the most part, are, you know, blue-collar folks, ordinary folks, a lot of their financial well-being tied up in the value of those homes, and really not fully aware of this threat that's coming their way.
Interesting. So what did your report find about the intersection of poverty or low-income communities and the expansion of chronic flooding?
Right. So one of the things that we pointed out in our report is, of course, there's physical risk of sea level rise exists all along our coastline. But there are places that are going to feel the impacts worse because they're going in with fewer resources to cope with the impacts of this flooding. So we found, for example, that there are nearly 175 communities nationwide that are going to see 10% or more of their housing stock at risk by 2045. And of these, nearly 40% currently have poverty levels above the national average. And some of these places are in coastal Louisiana, the places that Mr. Foray was talking about earlier in the show, in Terrebonne Parish, for example. So these are places that are going to feel this hit really hard. There are places like the eastern shore of Maryland where there are a number of elderly African-American homeowners who, again, don't have a lot of wherewithal to cope with the declining property values and the other challenges that are going to come their way through tidal flooding. Lots of blue-collar towns in New Jersey and Massachusetts, Oregon, Washington, that are similarly exposed. So this is not just a problem for the rich and famous. This is really for ordinary people all along our coastline.
Listeners, I'm talking to Rachel Cletus. She's the lead economist and policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're talking about a new report, Underwater, Rising Seas, Chronic Floods, and the Implications for U.S. Coastal Real Estate. Let's take a couple of calls now. Edward is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Edward, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Anthony. I've been here for 7 decades now, and I could just go chapter and verse through what I've witnessed. But the basement never flooded in my house before the 1990s. And the problem that I experienced recently was that with a reassessment of flood zones, my insurance, flood insurance, jumped 1,000%. And as one of your callers said, you got a $250,000 cap on that. So I've had to just self-insure. But I think here's the scenario that I see in the future. We're going to experience places like Norfolk and Miami are going to experience significant storm events that are going to destroy lots of waterfront property. And the people simply will not be able to come back to those areas. And you're going to see an even more, an increasing loss of tax revenue and population. Norfolk is already shrinking in population. They're talking about closing 25% of the schools here.
Edward, I want to jump right in there because this is a point that I know Rachel Cletus can address from this report. Rachel, go ahead and respond to Edward. This idea of shrinking tax base as people move away and the effect on communities.
What Anthony's speaking to is one of the biggest challenges here, which is the equity challenges that get exposed as sea levels rise along our coasts. What'll happen if we don't take national action, if we don't have policies and resources in place, is that many ordinary folks are going to find it too expensive or impossible to live along our coastline, and the coastline might get gentrified. So We can't leave people to be dealing with this challenge on their own. And at the same time, the investments we make have to be done with a long-term view in mind. So the physical challenge is real. There will be places where, unfortunately, we are going to have to find ways to pull back from the highest risk areas. But how we do that, and with equity built in, is going to really be the true test of our nation's ability to deal with this problem.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation to help us understand what some coastal cities are doing to mitigate flood damage. Joining me from Brooklyn, New York, is Susanna Drake. She's the founder of D-Land Studio, an urban design and architecture firm that specializes in helping cities mitigate climate change-related challenges. And Susanna Drake, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
So I'd love to, I know you've been listening along here, as an urban design specialist and architect that deals with challenges created by climate change, how do you see this challenge? How do you talk about it?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, technically there are ways that you can raise buildings. It gets more challenging when you think about how you're going to manage raising infrastructure and when you actually start to consider some of the geography and the geology of some of these areas. You know, we're working in Miami, we're working in New Orleans, and we're working in New York City, and they all have very specific kind of geographic conditions which can be managed in different ways.
Right. So for give us an example. I mean, if you contract with a particular city, I mean, talk about a particular city, how do you mitigate the effects of climate change? What kind of projects are underway to deal with this?
Okay. Well, for instance, in New Orleans, what we did was actually put in more permeable ground and green infrastructure strategies that help to absorb a lot of the surface water runoff. There, you know, we're dealing with a very high water table and that has elevated over the years and a lack of infrastructure in some of the underserved neighborhoods. And so we're trying to sort of establish a baseline condition so that people can actually get around and so that their houses aren't flooding. In coastal communities like New York, we recently did a proposal for the Regional Plan Association for the 4th Regional Plan, and we suggested actually a process of migration away from the waterfront and a repurposing of that waterfront zone into park space, into pure recreational space that might also have some agricultural component or might also have some energy production component, but not a place for living.
So how does that work, Susanna? When you propose migrating away from the waterfront, you're talking about encouraging people to leave their homes, right?
Well, I like the way you said that, encouraging people to leave their homes, because what we were trying to do is create an incentive to move to higher ground by developing upland properties along underserved transportation corridors that hadn't been built out. So provide amenity that attracts people away and then anticipate, in anticipation of that migration or anticipation of people having to move. And in the case of Jamaica Bay, we're dealing with a lot of people who are actually in public housing who don't really have a choice for where they're going to live. And so if you can create new resources in safe areas, in upland areas that are better connected to the city, it provides better economic opportunities for them as well.
Interesting. Rachel Cletus, we're listening to Susanna Drake talk about sort of localized responses to this. You made a reference a short while ago to national action. What are you referring to specifically?
Well, the challenge that a lot of local communities face is that they just don't have the resources and the wherewithal to make the kind of investments that Susanna just described, and they do need help, first of all, in assessing and understanding their risk, but then also being able to evaluate what kinds of options are available to them, and that can range from flood-proofing measures that help you stay in place all the way to some kind of a managed retreat. But to do any of those things at a substantial scale is going to require resources from the federal government, from state governments, et cetera. One of the very important things Susanna just said was that retreat is a very hard issue to grapple with. And
retreat, as in encouraging people to leave their homes.
From the very highest risk areas on a voluntary basis. As Mr. Foray said, this is about more than just homes. This is about people's cultural identity, their generational ties to a place. So there's a deep sense of loss. But if the risk, the physical risk is very high, we need to provide people with options to keep themselves safe. We need to give them places to go to, not just say you have to leave this place, but where are they going to go? How are they going to rebuild their lives? What are the new economic opportunities? Can they move as a community so that they can retain those community ties? Those are profound questions, and they can't be addressed adequately if we don't have enough resources available to local communities to make those decisions.
Let's go to Christine, who's calling from Palm Beach, Florida. Christine, you're on the air. Good to have you. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you for this discussion that you're having on this topic. I'm very passionate about it. I think one of the problems people may not be aware of that will have to do with property values is, you know, we're on limestone. With the higher temperatures, we're going to have more severe rainstorms. And between that and sea level rise, even people that are inland, this can cause settlement issues and structural damage to the concrete block houses, which most houses are built out of in Florida. And that is not covered under most insurance companies. I know this because I personally have this problem with my house. And in order to have it repaired with a lifetime warranty that's transferable so that you can sell the house, because if not, it's deemed structurally damaged. No one's going to buy your house. Not only do you have to come up with a large amount of money, but they have to put a whole helical piling system in around the house. And these are things that are going to affect everybody's houses just with the severe rainstorms and everything else. So that was my input.
Christine, I'm really grateful for your call and good luck to you down there in Palm Beach. Susanna, I'd love to get your take on what you heard from Christine from our caller in terms of, go ahead.
Well, no, Florida's a really interesting issue. And actually, I did want to just loop back one second to Rachel's issue on the resources going into this development, because
please do.
I think unless we have private sector resources as well going into the problem, it's not going to happen fast enough to keep pace with climate change. So that part of our Regional Plan Association plan was to create an incentive for private developers to build that new space to attract people away from the waterfront. But then getting back to the Palm Beach issue.
Suzanne, I'm going to jump in and ask you to hold that thought. We're coming up on a break, but we'll get right back to it when we return. Listeners, we're talking about rising sea levels, coastal real estate, and fears about a permanent housing market crash, among other challenges. You can join the conversations. Should state governments make a bigger push to relocate at-risk residents? We just talked about bigger incentives for the private sector to get involved in this. What would that look like? We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This. And on our latest episode, how Chip Wilson turned workout clothes into a fashion statement. And along the way, built a breakout brand, Lululemon, now worth billions. You can listen to How I Built This on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the staggering economic impacts associated with rising sea levels and coastal flooding. You can join the conversation. Are you affected by chronic flooding? Has the value of your house dropped because of it? And we're talking about a new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists headlined Underwater, Rising Seas, Chronic Floods, and the Implications for U.S. Coastal Real Estate. We've seen more and more superstorms over the past few years, Sandy, Irma, Maria, Harvey, and more. So here's Rutgers University climate scientist Robert Kopp on how rising sea level will affect flooding caused by those storms.
The simple thing to understand is that with a higher sea level, it requires less of a storm to produce the same amount of flooding, and the same storm will produce more flooding.
In other parts of New Jersey, there have been documented nuisance flooding events. Those can happen even when it doesn't rain.
And chronic flooding isn't just a problem for homeowners. It will affect all aspects of daily life. Here's Robert Freudenberg of the urban research firm Regional Plan Association speaking to Vox Media earlier this month about infrastructure problems.
Imagine if you're on a train and you had to wait for high tide to go out before the train could go through. And what a disruption to the system that would be. And then multiply that by every other train line or roadway that goes at sea level.
And here are some facts from the report that we're discussing from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Within 15 years, 147,000 existing homes and 7,000 commercial properties worth about $63 billion are at risk of flooding 26 times or more a year. Within 30 years, more than 300,000 homes and commercial real estate properties worth $136 billion face chronic disruptive flooding. My guests this hour are Rachel Cletus from the Union for Concerned Scientists and Susanna Drake, founder of D-Land Studio, a Brooklyn-based urban design firm that specializes in helping city with the challenges created by climate change. And Susanna, I want to come back to you because before the break, I cut you off and you were about to say something important about the situation down in Florida.
Well, it's interesting because we just started working in Flamingo Park and the Collins Historic Districts of the Miami Beach area. And, you know, they're beautiful historic resources, and we're tasked with making these buildings more resilient, so elevating the buildings. But when you elevate the buildings, you also have to think about elevating the infrastructure, elevating the roads, the sidewalks, how you mediate the transition from building to streetscape, right? And the issue is that that doesn't happen, or that's going to happen, or the sea level is rising incrementally. It's not going to be high all at once, so you can't just make it into Venice, right? So you have to think about how you can make a transition over time. So that's one issue there. But then the other issue is that a lot of Florida is actually sitting on limestone, which is like a big sponge. And you have the saltwater intrusion coming in, and that's meeting the freshwater aquifers. And I think that's going to cause an even greater environmental disaster in the future. So that's something that really needs to be on the radar of public officials.
Boy, Rachel Cletus, you know, I'm always hesitant. When we have to deliver bad news, obviously we're prepared to do it. But when I do programs like this, I want to give listeners some reason for hope, some way to feel hopeful in some way about what sounds like a really looming crisis. Is there some good news that we can talk about, or something that you're encouraged, that encourages you with regard to this crisis?
So I think the most important insight I hope that people will get from our research is that this is sober news, but we do still have choices. And the most important thing we need to do is use the time left available to us wisely. So as Ms. Drake pointed out, we now have these sea level rise projections that are telling us what the future is going to look like. And we can make decisions along the way to help prepare for it. How we use this time wisely, there are two major things we need to do. Of course, we need to cut our carbon emissions drastically. If we and the rest of the world can stay in line with the Paris Agreement goals, and if land-based ice loss is limited, our research shows that we can avert up to 80 to 85% of this chronic inundation that we described. Now, of course, we've baked in a lot of what's going to happen over the next couple of decades, but the further out in the century, we do have more agency over what happens through our emissions. The other important thing is what we do in terms of trying to adapt to the realities along our coastline and make the kinds of investments that Ms. Drake was alluding to help communities prepare. We have to be very clear-eyed, though, about what part of this is only going to help us in the short term and then start to fail because sea levels rise and overwhelm it. So really clear-eyed about what's a stopgap measure, but what really the long-term solution is. And in the case of Florida, it is the case that if we were to limit sea level rise, a lot of the end-of-century chronic inundation could be averted. But unfortunately, our emissions trajectory and everything we're hearing from the latest research on land-based ice loss is pointing us in the wrong direction, unfortunately. That means we have to prepare for the worst possible outcomes, even as we strive towards cutting our emissions.
So clearly the main driver, one of the main drivers, is global warming. But I also want to ask you, and this is a question for both of you, and I'll start with you, Rachel, about the kind of development that we're doing. And if you'll forgive me, I want to sort of stick with an example here in Boston because it's one that I'm familiar with. But I'm looking at the South Boston waterfront, which has been built up in dramatic ways, as you know. But I wanted to ask you about the way in which it's been built up. Lots of concrete, lots of steel and glass skyscrapers, not a lot of sort of soft banks going into the water. Do we have to think about different ways to build up these areas?
So this is what's most stunning. Even in places that are already experiencing a flooding, like we saw back in January and that Florida regularly sees, we're still seeing a lot of development happening in these highly exposed areas. So, for example, in the case of Florida, 15% to 20% of the at-risk homes that we identified in 2045 were built after the year 2000. What this means is we've got these really short-sighted market incentives and policy drivers that are just putting more people and property in harm's way. We've got to reorient these so that they take the longer view and are not encouraging this kind of risky development going forward.
Right. Susanna Drake, do you want to chime in on that?
Well, I do, because I think, in recent history, we've seen the highest and best use of the waterfront for say, high-end residential development. And I think we need to kind of shift our thinking to perhaps a different kind of economy that may be based more on an ecological bent or on tourism. And, you know, when you look at the example of, say, Miami Beach, there are 91,000 people that live there, but there are 15 million visitors. If you look at Venice, there are 55,000 people that live there, 30 million visitors. You know, those are tourist economies, and they can be structured differently than a traditional residential urban design structure. So, you know, I think that we need to be thinking of new urban design strategies for how we make these communities. And some of them may be based on a temporary inhabitation, and that might be a shift in thinking away from more permanent residents in the coastal zones.
Let's take a couple more calls. Steve is calling from Dover, Delaware. Steve, good to have you. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I agree with much of what's being said here about repurposing the coastlines. I regret that so often we have federal funds going into these areas and then the same thing happens again later and we just continue to see the same kind of building and destruction and cycles. And the local folks are not bearing the lion's share of the burden. It's the federal funds coming in that the rest of us in the country are putting into the federal coffers, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to me that we need to get a federal process going that the states can't really deal with.
Got it, Steve. Thanks. We're going to take that point up after one more call. I want to go to Bert, who's calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Bert, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Anthony. Actually, my question would be kind of similarly mirror the previous caller. We're moving. We're getting out of here. We sold our house about 6 weeks ago, going to go to Colorado. And people asked me why. And I said, well, one of the biggest reasons is the home. Such a big investment. At the same time, we're looking at, like, for example, in Virginia Beach, there was a discussion about we have a 15-year timeline to fix our stormwater drainage, and that's the most Virginia Beach is focusing on. At the same time, they just stripped out of a budget, city budget, any additional taxes for trying to speed that up. So it kind of parallels the other caller for a moment, because it's like I'm wondering, what does it take for local municipalities to know that what their skin in the game is on this. Thanks.
Bert, it's a great question. And Rachel Cletus, you were talking about reorienting incentives. I mean, it seems like what Bert was just talking about as well is incentives trying to get people in local government to understand what's at stake.
This is very challenging for local governments because what they're seeing simultaneously is the impacts in their municipalities, but also the threat to their property tax base. So, you know, just as another example from our study, there are nearly 100 zip code areas in Florida where we're seeing at-risk properties today that represent 40% or more of their local property tax base. Now, that's what communities rely on to fund critical services. It's also what they might turn to when they want to fund adaptation measures. If they go to the bond market, they might be looking for financing for adaptation measures. And the more they're identified as at-risk areas, they might find that credit rating start to be affected. We heard last year from Moody's and S&P that they are going to start looking at climate risk as one factor in terms of assessing a municipality's credit rating. If that actually happens, many of these exposed areas might find it harder and harder to raise money on the financial markets to invest in adaptation measures. What this points out to me is that we have a lot of places along our coastline who, frankly, not due to their own fault, are in a very tough situation. So we do need to, as a nation, come up with a response, yes, with all sectors of the economy involved, including the private sector, with innovative responses, governments with resources and wherewithal. But I think it's a mistake to think that just because this is happening in particular places to particular homeowners, that this is not a shared challenge for our nation.
That sounds like an incredibly profound point to take away from this report. Let's go to Catherine, who's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Catherine, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Really, I've enjoyed the conversation, but I think what we need to gear more towards is how do we mobilize this information and use it in order to impact local and federal legislation, and also target those who are still climate change deniers. We still have people who deny science. And if you'll forgive the analogy, I've worked in rescue for years, animal rescue. We do spay, neuter, education, but all of those are Band-Aid fixes. Until we change the legislation in our states and our government, these changes and the resources that we require won't be there.
Catherine, thanks for that. Suzanne, I want to come to you. Actually, I want to ask you both about the point that she made, but just what a challenging time this is in the era of climate change deniers serving in pretty prominent places right now in our public administration. Susanna, what do you say to Catherine?
Well, I think that one of the tremendous opportunities that designers have is to actually communicate this information to a broad audience. And so I think there are organizations that can help to disseminate these information beyond the design community. And I kind of would put to task the design community to actually get out there and start to create more propaganda, as it were, in relation to these issues. There are some organizations. There's a designer, Billy Fleming, at the McCarg Center at the University of Pennsylvania, who was one of the founders of the Indivisible movement. And I would say that he's starting to get some of this information out there through his involvement with both McCarg Center and Indivisible, which really is disseminating sort of political ideas on a grassroots level. I think the other issue is getting people, designers, into policy positions is very important. I've found that in my work, having designers work for, say, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers or work in elected office is actually helping to sort of move the needle. Those are both sort of critical issues.
Indeed.
But I think
Final word from Rachel Cletus. I'd love you to sort of chime in on the same issue. And this idea of, I mean, this report is, if nothing else, a call to action. How do you sort of turn and transform the information in this report into a sort of political action agenda?
Look, sea level rise is not a partisan issue. It doesn't matter whether you're a red or a blue state, whether you quote-unquote believe in climate change or not. Sea level rise is happening, and its impacts are affecting people right now along the U.S. coastline. So we cannot afford to waste any time anymore in this deeply partisan divide around climate change. Communities need action, and they need it now from their elected officials. So what I would say is I hope whether you're a homeowner whose home is worth $50,000 or a multi-million-dollar home, I hope what our research shows is this is coming home to people's daily lives. It's going to be really, really disruptive. So forget the dollar numbers, or if you only care about dollars, just focus on the dollar numbers. But understand that this is real and it's really going to affect people's lives and local communities.
All right. We need action and we need it now. With that, we're out of time. Rachel Cletus, lead economist and policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Rachel, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Susanna Drake, founding principal of D-Land Studio, a Brooklyn-based urban design firm. Susanna Drake, thank you as well.
Well, thank you very much.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation. You can also get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. Thank you for listening. This is On Point.